Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Energy futures were the indicator of choice today. Oil, down. Gas, down. Nuclear, down, obviously. Up, natural gas. Why finding an energy source we can handle is so hard. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by iShares Exchange-Traded Funds. Learn more about their ETFs at 1-800-iShares or iShares.com. iShares, keep evolving.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday today, the 15th of March. Good as always to have you with us. In Japan today, the latest on the nuclear crisis went like this. The government has asked 140,000 people, anybody within 20 miles or so of the Fukushima nuclear plant, to stay indoors. Companies and countries are evacuating their people. Governments, especially in Europe, are evaluating their own nuclear power plants and plans for them. But there's a catch, because moving away from nuclear power, with all of its obvious environmental risks, comes with some environmental consequences, too. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Adrian Hill reports.
Europe has reacted swiftly to Japan's nuclear crisis. European Union officials say they will stress test their 143 nuclear plants to see how prepared they are for disaster. Germany will close some of its older nuclear facilities. It's shelved plans to extend the life of others. But not everyone in Europe is turning their back on nuclear power. In France, the prime minister called it absurd to think the crisis in Japan will condemn nuclear energy. Alex Barnett with Jefferies International Bank isn't surprised.
Public perception of nuclear power is extremely positive.
Nuclear energy provides about three quarters of the power France uses. And says Barnett,
France really has few palatable options here. And so it doesn't surprise me that they're not sort of talking about a quick retrenchment from nuclear.
Backing off nuclear energy isn't going to be an easy call for many European countries. The EU has aggressive targets for cutting carbon emissions. Charles Ebinger is a researcher with the Brookings Institution.
The dilemma all these countries are going to face is their climate change goals and their views towards nuclear power may be in direct conflict if they decide to abandon nuclear.
Ebinger says it will be nearly impossible for the United Kingdom to meet its target emission reductions if it doesn't move ahead with a nuclear plan. And he says the technology to create and distribute reliable renewable energy, like wind and solar, isn't ready yet, at least on the scale required. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
The Fukushima reactors are obviously done, either from damage from the explosions and fire or by the introduction of corrosive seawater as a cooling mechanism. So Japan's going to have to find a way to make up that lost electric power capacity, as are other countries looking to rejigger their energy plans. And that will, in the short run at least, mean a boost for fossil fuels, one of them in particular. Marketplace's Eve Troe reports.
If people start really looking for an alternative to nuclear power, the energy contender poised to step in is natural gas.
Natural gas is best equipped to fill in for the portion of the market that would otherwise have been supplied by new nuclear power plants.
That's energy analyst Jeffrey Stiles. He says natural gas is a great plug-and-play alternative. It's relatively cheap, burns cleaner than coal, and unlike wind or solar, you can start pumping power plants with it right away.
Like nuclear, like coal, natural gas can provide 24/7 power.
Plus, it hasn't had a major disaster, like a well blowout, a mine collapse, or a radiation scare. That's added to its popularity with investors, says Bud Weinstein at McGuire Energy Institute.
When it comes to energy development, perception is just as important as reality.
But some do see danger in natural gas, especially a drilling method spreading in the U.S., hydraulic fracturing through shale. Kate Sending with the Natural Resources Defense Council says fracking towns have big problems.
Water contamination, air quality impacts.
She says other countries, like China and Poland, now want to start fracking for natural gas, and the industry hasn't dealt with the risk.
Any increased production of natural gas has got to come with a much more stringent oversight and regulation at every level.
The global natural gas industry is watching to see whether that will happen in the U.S. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
This was not a good day for stock investors almost anywhere on the planet. Key markets in Asia and Europe were clobbered. In New York today, all three major indices closed down a percent or so. The good news, if that's where you want to go, is that they were down 2.5% at the open. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. According to the U.S. Geological Survey, there have been three more earthquakes in Japan so far today. Didn't say aftershocks because all three of those quakes were magnitude 6.0 or higher, which would be enough to send people almost anywhere else in the world diving under their desks for cover. So the earth has clearly not settled around Japan, and with the problems at the Fukushima plant still hanging overhead, people there are understandably a little unsettled themselves. We've got Rob Schmitz on the line from Japan once again today. Hey, Rob.
Hey, Kai.
So first of all, I guess, what's the mood? What's it like?
Well, I spent most of the day in Tokyo, and the people I spoke with there were not encouraged at all by a national address given this morning by the chief cabinet secretary. He broke the news that radiation was indeed leaking from one of the reactors at the Fukushima power plant. Prime Minister Naoto Kan also gave a national address today, and he told everyone there was a high risk of further radioactive leakage. That was right after he told everyone to be calm. And take a guess which part of that mixed message Japan's stock market glommed onto. So, you know, the stock market is now in a free fall. It's had the worst 2 days in 40 years. So there's clearly panic in the market here.
Are people trying to get out? I mean, panic is a strong word when you talk about the markets, but it's even stronger when you start talking about people.
Yeah, and I'd say from my conversations today in Tokyo, people are starting to panic too. I was at the train station today, and I talked to many people who were leaving. They'd heard the radiation news, and they'd also heard that winds would be blowing that radiation towards the city. Whether or not the amount of radiation found outside the reactor would travel all the way to Tokyo seemed unclear, but they weren't going to wait around to find out. You know, many folks I spoke to were going to stay with extended families in unaffected parts of southern and western Japan. And I met a lot of foreigners who were on their way to the airport, flying home. Foreign embassies are starting to tell their countrymen to leave. And many foreign businesses in Japan have relocated their foreign staff either outside the country or to unaffected cities with big airports like Osaka.
So, Rob, when you and I spoke yesterday, you pointed out how the Japanese tend to come together in times like this and do what the government says, and they have a way of just snapping into line. The gentleman I spoke with on the show on Friday said the exact same thing. That does not sound like what's actually happening.
Yeah, you know, and I think the reason for that is that the Japanese are receiving mixed messages about what's going on at the Fukushima nuclear power plant. On the one hand, you've got the prime minister saying, watch out for more radiation. And on the other, the company that runs the plant insists that radiation levels aren't very high. But then you look at reports in the Japanese media, it's clear the situation at Fukushima isn't improving. Add to the fact that most people simply don't understand how nuclear reactors work, nor much about radiation, other than it's bad. And you've got a situation with a lot of unknowns, and by nature, people are a little scared of the unknown.
All right, Rob, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
Marketplace's Rob Schmitz in Japan for us. The American Red Cross is collecting donations for Japan. Almost $2 million has been raised so far by people making $10 contributions from their cell phones. And companies are doing their bit. U.S. businesses have promised more than $50 million for the relief effort, money that has to come from someplace. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler reports.
Following natural disasters, drug company Abbott has often donated products like antibiotics or rehydration solutions. But Abbott spokesperson Kathy Pickus says Japan is different.
After speaking with all of our relief partners and those engaged in the response, they requested cash.
Abbott is donating about $3 million. General Electric has pledged $5 million. Goldman Sachs, $6 million. Stephen Jordan tracks corporate philanthropy at the Business Civic Leadership Center, a nonprofit affiliate of the Chamber of Commerce.
You can already see this is going to rival Haiti. Just if it had already peaked, it's going to be up there. And I don't think it's peaked at all.
If corporate donations continue at this pace, Jordan says the financial response will be the second biggest in history behind the Southeast Asian tsunami in 2004. But sometimes companies can be too generous. Kurt Whedon is the author of Smart Giving is Good Business. He says corporations should resist raiding a budget that supports a local hospital or arts group.
taking out of one pocket to support a crisis in Japan out of someone else's pocket that otherwise would have been receiving the money.
Some companies are providing incentives for individuals to get involved too. For example, a donation to the Red Cross will earn you mileage points on American Airlines, and Citigroup is waiving fees on wire transfers to Japan. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve met today on interest rates. No change, as expected, although they did take a good couple of paragraphs to say so in the official written statement that comes out at the end of every Fed meeting. Bernanke and company do plan, as promised, to keep buying up Treasury bonds through the end of June. What happens after that, however, is the really big question mark, given what's been happening around the world. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports on some new worries that foreigners could be losing their appetite for American debt.
Today's statement from the Fed called attention to a significant rise in commodity prices and a sharp run-up in the cost of oil. That underscores the pressure on the Fed to stop buying U.S. bonds, a policy that many view as inflationary. Also today came word that China cut its holding of U.S. debt for the third straight month in January. Now what happens if the Japanese start cashing in their U.S. debt to fund their disaster recovery bill? Marilyn Cohen watches the bond market for Envision Capital Management.
When you have the largest players that belong on the field starting to leave the field, Japan, China, we're going to have to entice other buyers, and the only way you do that is with higher interest rates.
But to build on that metaphor, the Fed could be viewed as the marching band that refused to yield, as the song says. Investment advisor Axel Merck thinks there's an increasing chance the Fed will stay on the field to signal its determination to keep interest rates low.
As these headwinds intensify, I would not be surprised if anything that will be easing further down the road rather than tightening.
Even though Merck believes that course, as he puts it, is playing with fire, an inflationary fire in the future. But of course, nobody knows what the future will bring, and at Jefferies & Company, Chief Financial Economist Ward McCarthy remains optimistic that China, Japan, and other foreign countries will keep being attracted to U.S. debt.
Especially in this uncertain environment, I think they'll continue to find treasuries to be a safest place to be, even if rates are lower than they would like.
It's clearly something the Fed and the rest of us will need to keep watching closely. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Coming up, Rocky Mountain lows.
Job growth in Colorado would need to be in excess of 50,000 jobs a year for the next 3 years to pull out of our budget crisis.
Our series Economy 4.0 returns, but first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial started the day down nearly 300 points, but managed to close with a loss of just 137 points, if you can call it that, 1.1%, finished at 11,855. The NASDAQ down 33 points, 1.25%. Ended things at 26.67. The S&P 500 slid 14 points. Again, 1.1%, wrapped up trading at 1281. The potential nuclear crisis in Japan is still the big concern in the markets. General Electric lost another 1.5% today. GE, as you might remember, designed one of the reactors in question. Texas Instruments fell nearly 2% today after reporting substantial damage at a key plant in Japan. Intel deleted more than 3%. Bond prices rose, dropped the yield on the 10-year T-note to 3.3%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by T. Rowe Price, understanding the connections of a complex global economy. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence at TRoePrice.com. By Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the internet and stopping unwanted mail. Reputation.com. And by iShares Exchange-Traded Funds. Learn more about their ETFs at 1-800-iShares or iShares.com. iShares, keep evolving. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes for the month of February. The Labor Department releases the Producer Price Index for February. And the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee looks at online consumer privacy. This is the second in a series of hearings examining how users' information is stored, collected, and used, and what more Congress can do to protect Americans online. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Even as former Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak tries to fend off corruption charges at home, he's got an overseas problem he kind of has to deal with. What to do with all the property he and his family own? Middle Eastern dictators have built up large holdings overseas, often including swank properties in London, England. Marketplace's Stephen Beard took a tour.
Hello. Hello, is there anyone there?
No one's at home at number 28 Wilton Place in Belgravia. At least no one's answering the door. Not surprising, perhaps. This five-story townhouse belongs to Gamal Mubarak, son of the ousted Egyptian dictator. My expert on upscale London property is William Green. William, what do you think?
This is a gem of a house, Stephen. It's Georgian property, double-fronted. It's got a wrought iron balcony to what will be a first-floor drawing room, which will have probably 12, 15-foot high ceilings, be very formally laid out.
How much is this one worth, do you think?
A freehold property in this neck of the woods is going to be nudging the £15 million mark, I suspect.
$15 million or $22, $23 million?
Very likely.
We've now come about 5 miles north to another immensely expensive neighbourhood. We're on a tiny road called Winnington Close, standing in front of another property fit for a dictator or a dictator's son. This one belongs to Saif Gaddafi.
Well, this is a beautiful house. It's got an in-and-out drive. It's a double-fronted neo-Georgian residence.
And it has some pretty luxurious facilities.
You have a private cinema. I gather this one is suede lined. I believe there's a swimming pool as well and a jacuzzi.
Gaddafi Jr. put this mansion on the market last month for £11 million or $18 million. But it may prove a bit difficult to sell. It's now been occupied by protesters. Rather shy ones. Faces Hello. Appear at the window, but they're reluctant to speak to me.
American Public Radio. Could I have a word with somebody?
They won't let me in, but after half an hour, one of the protesters comes out. He says he's Belkacem Algeriani and that he and his friends are Libyans. Why are you occupying the property? What point are you trying to make?
We are just here to make sure this house go back to the Libyan people, which this house belonged to.
Are you enjoying the facilities? Have you used the jacuzzi yet?
No, we didn't allow even us to use all these things. Only what is necessary, like the toilet or the kitchen.
What about the cinema?
No.
And the swimming pool?
Not to enjoy. We're not here not having a party. We are here to look after.
None of the permanent residents in this district that I approached wanted to comment on their neighbour, Mr. Gaddafi, except one. Israeli-born writer Saul Zadka.
I'm a bit uncomfortable to live next door to the mass murderer or a serial killer.
Zadka deplores the large number of African despots, Arab dictators and Russian mafiosi that have over the years been allowed a safe haven in London, where they live in some luxury, many, it seems, in his neighbourhood. We drive along the nearby Bishop's Avenue, often called Billionaire's Row.
And as you could see from all the number of cranes on both sides of the street, that they are still in the process of expanding.
More dictators on the way, perhaps.
Yeah, I know. I mean, and I think that the British are in love with dictators. They like the lavishness and the outrageous lifestyle of dictators. There is something mesmerizing.
He says the dictators may lie low here for a while, the government may freeze a few of their assets, but it won't be long before they're back openly enjoying their ill-gotten real estate in London. I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
We should finally retire the idea of Arab exceptionalism, the belief that people in that region do not want democracy or are not ready for it.
Commentator Lawrence Haas.
They want it, they're ready for it, and we should help them get it. America has lots of ways to promote freedom and democracy, not the least of which is with foreign aid. These days, we spend upwards of $50 billion a year in foreign aid. which we send to more than 100 nations and to global institutions like the World Bank. But all too often, we use foreign aid to support dictators who may be our allies, but who are also very unpopular with their own people. After World War II, we focused our foreign aid largely around the Cold War. We sent aid to support our allies and to help groups in other nations overthrow their communist leaders. We didn't worry much about the human rights records of those recipients, who included Latin American dictators. Since September 11th, we have refocused foreign aid largely around the war on terror. We have sent aid to nations that are fighting terrorists and to help groups overthrow governments that support terrorism. We don't worry much about the human rights record of, let's say, Pakistan. Unfortunately, all of that puts us on the wrong side of our values, the values of freedom and democracy. It also makes us the enemy of the very people we should be supporting. They include the brave students and labor leaders and journalists and opposition figures in Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Jordan and elsewhere who are trying to bring democracy to their own countries. We have to fight the war on terror, just like we had to fight the Cold War. But the people of the Middle East want more freedom, and we can allocate more of our foreign aid budget to helping them get it. That will make the world a safer place and make America a more secure nation.
Lawrence Haas is a senior fellow at the American Foreign Policy Council in Washington, D.C. Take a second to share your thoughts, no matter where you work or where you live. You can write to us through our website, marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. Ohio Governor John Kasich released his proposed budget today. It's fairly grim because the state financing refrain is by now a familiar one, some combination of spending cuts, tax increases, or both of them. In boom times, the budget process can be almost fun. In a recession, we learn how badly it's actually broken. Our series Economy 4.0 is all about how to make the financial system work better for more people. Today, our special correspondent David Brancaccio travels to Colorado, where the budget rules are so tough, they've led to some creative thinking.
This is what happens when there's no money to shore up a 70-foot dam that once held over a billion gallons of water. A jagged stone gap and a little creek is what's left of Colorado's Castlewood Dam. Back in 1933, after years of safety warnings, the thing collapsed. Result, two people dead, and downtown Denver, 30 miles away, underwater.
My utmost concern is public safety, but dams do fail.
Mark Haynes runs Colorado's effort to make sure about 1,900 mostly privately owned dams do no harm. His team identifies problems, but he can't force owners to fix them.
One here shows there's no spillway and has an inoperable outlet. Here's another one that's a dam partially breached due to overtopping.
That's the water going over the dam.
That's correct, yeah.
What Haynes can do is tell owners to drain reservoirs, which is not a great solution in the arid West, which needs more water, not less. So the state pitched in by subsidizing cheap loans to cover repairs. That is until this recession, when lawmakers siphoned off that fund to balance the budget. Right now, Colorado has to close a $1 billion gap in a budget of $7 billion. The new governor, a Democrat, has a plan to close a prison and for big cuts to public schools in a state where a third of school districts already do four-day weeks to save money.
Job growth in Colorado would need to be in excess of 50,000 jobs a year for the next 3 years to pull out of our budget crisis.
Steve Toole once headed the budget committee in the State House. He's a Republican who prefers fixing the budget by attracting new jobs, but he's seen the forecast this year, less than half the hiring required. Toole met for 2 days with other ex-lawmakers, a group equally split, GOP and Democrat, to see what bright minds, free from the usual pressures of politics, might do with the budget. The non-binding exercise, organized by the Denver Post, resulted in a call to, listen to this, from a rock-ribbed Republican.
We made the decision to increase the state income tax from 4.63% to 5%.
As a practical matter, is it possible to raise those taxes?
It's probably not.
You see, there's something called the Taxpayer Bill of Rights, an amendment to the Colorado Constitution that means legislators can lower taxes, but only voters can raise them. Breaking out of this awful pattern of budgets shattering every time the economy freezes up requires changes that voters have a tough time digesting, in part because it's dreary budget stuff. In some places, like Colorado, this would mean changing the state's constitution. A thorny process, but something that could happen, says Carol Hedges, director of the Colorado Fiscal Policy Institute, if debate is put in terms that resonate.
We ask the question of, is Colorado worth it? Are we willing to invest? And I think most Coloradans at least are willing to contemplate that question.
If states don't, something could crack. If not infrastructure like dams, then possibly systems that leave tax decisions to the voters. In Colorado, I learned of an untested strategy that could force a massive overhaul. A group of lawyers, including a former congressman, contends that handing the power of taxation directly to voters was illegal because it robbed the legislature of its ability to govern in violation of the U.S. Constitution. Once a legal challenge is filed, a decision could take years, not necessarily in time for the next budget mess produced by the inevitable next economic downturn. In Denver, I'm David Brancaccio for Marketplace.
There's more from David and from our series Economy 4.0 on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. And by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals. On the web at Putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, two quick observations about Japan on the way out. First, the Federal Reserve, not mentioned at all in the statement today by the agency that's supposed to be looking at the very macroeconomic picture. Japan. To be fair, economists are split on what the earthquake might actually mean here or globally, but still kind of surprising not to see it in the statement someplace. And in that vein, Goldman Sachs guessed today that Toyota stands to lose $73 million a day in profit for as long as its Japanese plants are shut down, which, as of right now, is through tomorrow at least. We'll have more, by the way, on Japanese carmakers and the earthquake on the show tomorrow. But for now, we got to go. That's Marketplace from American Public Media. That's APM. Today, the Dow dropped 137 points, 1.1%. The NASDAQ down 33 points, about 1.25%. The S&P 500 slid 14 points, 1.1%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Coming up next time, back here, Russian politicians are trying to push people toward healthier lives without losing their jobs.
Tobacco is like bread. Well, this is what they say. It's like bread. They need it every day.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.